Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. University of Tulsa Theater's latest production features Molière's classic comedy Tartuffe, which begins this evening. Reset amidst Texas oil men and TV evangelists in contemporary times, Tartuffe is the story of a pious con man who gets a wealthy patriarch to give nearly everything, home, hearth, even his daughter, over to the enterprising scoundrel, despite the futile pleas of a knowing family. TU Theater presents this 17th century classic tonight through Sunday evening with a matinee on Sunday as well in the University of Tulsa's Chapman Theater in Kendall Hall. My guest today is the director of the production, Stephen Marzoff, an assistant professor of theater who's been a Chicago-based actor whose own credits feature numerous productions at San Diego's Old Globe Theater, as well as the prestigious Chicago Steppenwolf Theater Company and the La Jolla Playhouse, among others. He joins us today to talk about Tartuffe here on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Marzoff, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
TU Theater's presenting Molière's Tartuffe. Now, I assume as a part of students' educations, you want to have a classic production at some point. Why did you particularly choose Tartuffe as the vehicle?
Well, we had just done, in conjunction with Tulsa Shakespeare in the Park, we did Much Ado About Nothing this past summer. And I think it was important to do something other than Shakespeare. And when we were thinking about it, we felt that it worked for this particular group of students that we had, this particular play. And I'm a big fan of Molière anyway. I mean, Shakespeare and Molière are the two sort of classic Western drama dudes.
Maybe some Sheridan and Marlowe, too. And that's really what you see as far as revivals of some of this classic theater, right? Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right.
Well, for those who don't know Tartuffe, what is the story of Tartuffe?
Well, the story is it's a con man who dresses up as a religious figure and finds this gullible guy in his family and kind of goes hog wild with him as far as taking over the deed to the guy's house, wreaks havoc with the family, tries to have sexual relations with his wife.
And his daughter.
And his daughter, and is finally found out towards the end of the play. But by then, the gullible man has given him everything that he owns, and so he's kind of screwed.
And this was a very controversial play when it was first produced in like 1660-something.
Yeah, it was actually banned 6 different times in the 17th century because they felt that it was attacking religion. And I don't believe that. I think that Tartuffe is a con man. He's not. It's not poking fun at religion. It's. I mean, he could be a used car salesman for all anybody could care.
Well, I think the thing is that it must have felt like it was too close to home for the Bishop of Paris.
That's right. Archbishop. You're exactly right.
And I think the parallels were that as Tartuffe takes over Orgon's home, the parallels is that the Archbishop was sort of whispering in Louis, I think it was the 14th. Yeah, Louis the 14th's ear and sort of running the country the same way.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then, of course, at the end of Molière's original play, Louis the 14th comes in to save the day.
Right. Well, of course, you're not doing it in French. You're doing an English translation. What is the translation you're using?
We're using the Richard Wilbur translation, which came out in, I think, 63. Mm-hmm. And about 80% of the productions of Tartuffe use this. It's in verse. There are rhyming couplets, but it's incredibly understandable. So in a lot of ways, you know, dealing with the students, it's like dealing with Shakespeare and how the verse is used. Just you have rhyming couplets at the end of each verse line.
Yeah. It's interesting because so much of the acting young actors see is naturalistic acting. What's it like to sort of get their voices around rhyming couplets?
Hard. Really hard. You know, this play, it has some homage to the Commedia dell'arte as well. And so one of the things early on is that I think the students were struggling with that sort of style because it's completely different than what we're used to today. I mean, comedy is all in masks. You have stock characters. You have created scenarios. And so what we did about a weekend, because they were having a hard time with it, is we had a day where we just did improv in Commedia as their character. So like the Orgon character would be parallel to the Pantalone character from Commedia. And Tartuffe would be with the El Capitano. So it has been tricky physically with them. And then also with the verse, like I said, it's like Shakespeare. So this has been quite a production in order to get everybody understanding everything.
So when you're speaking in rhyming couplets, I would think the tendency would to make it sing-song. So how do you avoid doing that? What are the sort of tricks you give to your actors to avoid that?
As an actor, what's important is to find what are called operative words in a verse line. Usually they're nouns and verbs. And sometimes it's important to hit the rhyming couplets. And like you said, if you keep on hitting it, I mean, the audience is going to fall asleep after about 10 minutes. So what I tell them is that if you look at – usually with a rhyming couplet, there is an adjective that is connected to it. And I told them about 40-50% of the time you hit that adjective right before you hit the actual couplet. And it doesn't make it sing-songy anymore. So it's very technical in order to make this work. But once they bought into it, it's starting to sail now.
Yeah. What are the types of points where you would want to emphasize the rhyme? When there's a joke being made?
Yes. A lot of times Doreen, who is the maid character, I'm usually having her hit it because she's kind of the smart aleck character. Other times if it's a really sort of poignant, something funny to really pop it out. But, you know, like you said, I mean, if you keep on hitting it, it's bad news bears.
Yeah. Well, in this particular production, you've updated it. It's now in the turn of this century, the 21st century. But I think Tartuffe is one of those pieces that is constantly being updated. And it's been put in every there's been an Indian production which involves Sikh priests and things like that. Yeah. And, I mean, it's been everywhere and done in every sort of way. What were the decisions that went into your updating it?
First one was budget. to put it in a sort of its traditional style is pretty expensive with the costumes,
sure.
The set and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, too, is that when we decided to do this, I've always thought of Tartuffe as a TV evangelist. For some reason, when I grew up in Florida in the 80s and early 90s, and during that time, Robert Tilton that's when he was running things, and he had an $80 million ministry. And, of course, you know,
Jimmy Swagger.
Yes,
yeah,
all the same.
Jim Baker,
all of these, yes.
All these guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not Billy Graham. I'm like, you know, I'm not.
No.
One of the things is that I'm not poking fun at TV evangelists per se, but sort of the fraud aspect of some of them. And so I always wanted to model Tartuffe after Robert Tilton. So when I thought about that, I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I want to make it super contemporary. And then where can I set it? Because Orgon has to be a wealthy guy. It says that in the script. And so I felt, well, he could be an oil tycoon down in Dallas. So that's how I came up with the idea. So it was a mix between sort of what I've wanted to do and also budgetary constraints with the department. And it really works. It's funny, but it really works.
Now, as I've read about Tartuffe, Orgon at some point knew about Tartuffe's shady past, right? Or is it sort of allude to it that they were friends before he came to the household?
Yes, he has a monologue early on. So one of the things that I also did is that it's hard for me to wrap my brain around, and I think other people, that Orgon would be this foolish and that everybody, you know, he has a younger wife in the play who's the hot, attractive younger wife because his original wife passed away, they say in the script. And it was always hard for me to wrap my brain around, why would she stay with him if he was this foolish? So early on in the play, the maid character says that in the late troubles that he played an able part for our king, which would have been King Louis XIV at the time. So one of the things I was thinking about, too, was also the financial crisis that happened in 2008 when everything crashed. And I felt like that would also be a good hook for this modern adaptation of it, that's where he kind of lost his mind. Because when that happened, I was living in Chicago at the time, and I saw people doing some crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In 2007 through 2009. So that's kind of how I also came to the sort of modern adaptation. But then to get back to your question about Orgon, he does have a monologue right after that where he comes in and he says, you know, I was down and I saw at church there was this humble man and he was, you know, running and getting holy water for me at the door. He knew that I was really upset and I was down on hard times and he was taking care of me in church, so I wanted to take care of him in my home.
And that's how it all
begins. That's how it all came to pass.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your actors and how they're adapting to this modern retelling of Tartuffe.
At this point, they're doing well. This is a hard play. Like I said, you have the verse, you have the rhyming couplets, you have the commedious style, which I think is important just to allude to in it, which we do.
And the commedious style, for those who are not versed in theater history, how is that? Is it a very stylized?
It is. It's very, very physical, very stylized. Everyone is in masks except for the lover characters. And I think the best way that you can relate commedia to contemporary times is if you look at sitcoms. You know, like Two and a Half Men, for instance. It has sort of a commedia scenario. The characters are in some ways based on commedia characters.
Very broad.
Broad, over-the-top sort of acting style. This production is not broad and over-the-top, but some of the physicalities that they have relate back to the commedia dell'arte.
Give us an example.
Orgon, played by Justin Blankenship, was based on the Pantalone character. And the Pantalone character, the mask would have a really long nose. He's kind of hunched over. He's always pointing, you know, kind of talks like this all the time. Shame on you kids for doing this to me.
Get off my lawn.
Yeah, get away, you know. I wanted him to physicalize that, and it really helped. That's when the actors finally dropped into this play, is when we took that one day to really work the sort of improv commedia stuff with them that they really started to drop in. Most of the actors that are in it are seniors, and I think there are four sophomores. So this was also – I wanted to give them an opportunity as the senior class to do this play, which, I mean, I think it's awesome. You know, I'm trained from the Old Globe, and so I've done a lot of Shakespeare, a lot of Restoration comedy, a lot of Molière. And so I wanted to give them the opportunity to do this before they leave school.
What fuels that love for that Restoration era of theater?
First of all, it's hilarious. I mean, the thing with Shakespeare and also Restoration comedy, Molière, et cetera, about classical theater is people are afraid of the language because we are a visual-based society now. We are no longer aural. So I think that's why people get scared of it. But once you understand the language, it's awesome. Like in Tartuffe, it's a really funny play. A lot of the Restoration comedy, a lot of Shakespeare's body jokes. It's really funny,
well,
and it's universal,
I think people see the language on the page first because you don't see a production that often.
That's exactly right.
And that the just reading it on the page, it doesn't live as well until you actually see somebody acting it and you see that visual element, and all of a sudden the language falls into place.
That's exactly right. You know, I mean, even I'm pretty sure Shakespeare would back me up on this too. His plays were not meant to be read. They were meant to be performed. And I think Molière is the same way. You know, if it's based on the Commedia dell'arte, they improvised. They had these scenarios with the stock characters, but this was all about performing. And so you're right, because if you're just looking at it on the page, and I know the first time I looked at Molière or Shakespeare, I went, there is no way I'm doing anything. I want nothing to do with this. Just give me the contemporary stuff or film scripts.
Now, you talked about using the commedia style in preparation. Are they doing it actually with this modern dress but with commedia props like a mask, or you just use that as a preparation tool to do it in a modern situation?
I used it as a prep tool, but they have still kept a little bit of the physicality. It's not extreme but a subtle version of it. So, again, the Orgon character – please come and see it, the show. If you come and see it, you'll notice physically what he's doing. He has that little bit of a hunch. He's pointing a lot. He kind of has a broad sort of step that he takes, and that is based on the Pantalone character. Mm-hmm. But it's subtle. It's not the extreme version of it.
It's like a sitcom version.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. Two and a Half Men.
My guest today is Stephen Marzoff, assistant professor of theater at the University of Tulsa and director for University of Tulsa Theater's production of Molière's Tartuffe, which opens tonight and runs through Sunday with a matinee on Sunday as well and a Sunday night performance. So five performances all at the Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater. So give us a sense of how this play translates to Dallas, Tartuffe being sort of a huckster evangelist type of character, because it seems like in the original he's pious, but we don't get the sense that he's clerical or, you know, not an official clergy person. Of course, back then there was only one church, and now we got a gazillion. Give us a sense of how you adapted these various characters. You mentioned Orgon as an oil man. Mm-hmm. His wife is his second wife, and then he has, of course, a daughter who he's planning to wed to somebody else, but then he turns around and awards her to Tartuffe.
Yeah. As far as Tartuffe goes, you know, one of the things that I was playing with is, you know, when he doesn't come out. This play is done in five acts. We do it in two, but it was originally written in five acts. Tartuffe doesn't come out until act three in this play. So you hear all of this stuff for the first probably half hour of our play about Tartuffe this, Tartuffe that, but you never see him. So then he finally comes out. And one of the things I wanted to do is And Ken Leipzig is playing it, and Ken's going to be very good in this role. I wanted people to look at him as soon as he comes out and go, something's a little off about him, but is he as bad as what everybody is saying? And then after you get through the first scene with him, then all of a sudden the Elmir character, who is Orgon's wife, comes out. And then all of a sudden that's when the greasy car salesman comes out, lustful guy, all of this stuff. And a lot of the characters, I think the best way that I can describe it is it's kind of like Commedia dell'arte meets Jerry Springer, I think is the best way I can put it, with not only the costumes but with sort of the way that I've gone with these characters. They're not broad in the sense of the Commedia style broad, but it is like a sitcom. It's really easy, and the actors found this out early on, to fall into modern sort of acting. And when you do that with this play, it becomes angry. People are shouting at each other. It's like a Sam Shepard play, and if we do that, we're in big trouble with Tartuffe.
So it has to be cultured and mannered?
In some ways, yes. Not in sort of the comedy of manners way, but it's not as sort of aggressively visceral as a lot of the acting style wants to be today, especially when you think about this situation. You've been duped and you find out that this guy's been duping you for X amount of time, and then, of course, you're upset about it.
And the family and the whole part is the family knows that this guy's a fraud, except the patriarch.
That's exactly right.
And it's a pretty good setting as a Texas oil man, a guy who could probably say, okay, it's going to be my way in this household.
And yeah. That's exactly how it comes across. Yep.
And so the natural reaction would be to speak louder, and you have to be a little more cultured and a little more mannered.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And what I use is variation in the argument. Acting is all about an argument. And if you can find variation in it and not just scream, 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 but you can find variation in it, that's when it really captures the audience.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the rest of the cast. You mentioned some of the leads and how they're adapting to Orgon and Tartuffe, but give us a sense of the other players in your company.
We have the lovers played by Cody McCoy and Kaylin Rogers, and again, based on the comedic characters, they would be the unmasked ones, and they go back and forth between being super in love with each other and then super angry with each other and then right back in love with each other without missing a beat. They kind of have some Jerry Springer moments, I think. If you watch some of his shows, you can see the worn, torn lovers coming in, upset with each other, and then by the end they're kissing and everything's back to the way that it should be. The maid, Doreen, which is a great role, is played by Nicole Billups, and she's kind of the smart aleck character. She's the one that kind of...
She's the knowing one, right?
She's the one, yes. She is probably the smartest person in the play, next to maybe Elmir, who is Orgon's wife. But she's a step ahead of everybody else. So she's the one that kind of dictates what happens in scenes, whether it's with Orgon, whether it's with the lovers. She's the one kind of driving the scenes and dictating what's going on. And Nicole is really bought into the Commedia style because I want her character to mimic everybody else. So if somebody does something stupid, she's just going to mimic it right back to them.
The son character?
Yes, we have Demise, who in some ways is like the hot shot, hot dog kind of cowboy son that just blows up on the turn of a coin. And he's the one that really, really, really is against Tartuffe because he wants to marry Valere and Marianne are the lovers. He wants to marry Valere's sister. And if Tartuffe weds his sister, he can't marry Valere's sister. So he's really upset with this whole thing. He has some sort of really funny physical stuff that he is doing too. And that's played by Chase Wheaton-Worrell. And so that kind of fleshes out the family aspect of it. There are a couple of other characters we have. It's usually played by a man. Monsieur Loyal is played by it's a woman, Madame Loyal. She kind of has an ode to how's the best way that I can describe Taylor Keefe is playing that role, Taylor's character. I wanted it to be, if anybody's ever seen Inglourious Basterds, the German character in it, Fritz, I can't remember his name. Mm-hmm. I wanted her to mimic him in some ways because he's so likable, but you can tell there's something off with him.
Yeah.
And so I wanted her to kind of, in some ways, mimic his characterization, and she has. It's still funny.
This would be the Christopher Waltz character.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. That's right. That's it. Yes.
Yeah. And he's the one who basically brings them down, and he's got this air of likability, but he's just evil.
Yes, that's right. And that's why I wanted her to embody that, because there's something that's incredibly likable about her on stage. But you go, again, like Tartuffe, something's a little off here. And then the Louis the 14th character, which was probably the hardest thing in adapting this to 21st century, is Shiloh Thaxton playing it. And Shiloh is basically a representative of the State Department. Because, you know, that's a really hard. I thought about maybe governor of Texas. No, let's just go bigger than that. So he is a representative of the presidency in a lot of ways.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, my guest today is Stephen Marzolf. TU Theater is presenting Molière's Tartuffe tonight through Sunday at the Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater. Now, you have this wonderful thrust stage. How are you using it for the production?
I'm actually using the thrust. Other productions that have been done in here, we did Waiting for the Parade in Biloxi Blues last year, and we did not use the thrust. And what a thrust is, of course, it's three-quarters, quasi-three-quarters of this space. So there will be at times where the audiences, there are two VOMs, and the audience will see the backs of some of the actors. They'll be on that VOM, but you will always be able to see another person fully. And that's kind of how you use the thrust. That's also been tricky for the actors because they're used to proscenium spaces where they're open or they're facing each other. But, you know, they started freaking out when they went, wait, my back is to the audience? Why? And I went, just trust me on this. It's going to work.
Now, do you have a nice set for the piece?
We do, yes. In fact, all of the design elements, students have designed set, lights, with the exception of costumes, sound. And the set is it's an ode to kind of a mansion in Texas, but it's missing some of the interior walls. And my feeling with that is that Tartuffe has come in and knocked the walls out of this house. So there are realistic pieces, but then you'll have gaping space. And that was kind of my feel for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the students handle the various technical elements? What are some of the distinctive parts of the production?
Well, like I said, you know, with scenically having that sort of empty space, we had initially talked about maybe having marionette ropes with pictures and crosses hanging down, like Tartuffe has become this puppet master. We've only really had 3.5 weeks to put this show up, so that unfortunately had to kind of go out the window. But the other thing that's kind of cool about the design is we have all of the borders up, and so it's just kind of suspended in air. So it still gives that sense of what I was talking about, the marionette kind of feel. Mm-hmm. So you'll have, like I said, set pieces, and then you'll have the upper part and the lower part, and like the baseboards and whatnot in, and then just gaping space. So it looks like that the walls have been removed. The sound... Grant Goodner did that, and the sound is it's all Billy Joe Shaver, and I don't know if anybody knows him, but he's kind of a tongue-in-cheek country singer. You know, one of his things is, he says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." We use that in this show. So it's kind of tongue-in-cheek. The production is itself. The sound is. And we're also using video in it, too, at the beginning of the show and then the beginning of our act two, which is show some of the financial crisis and then also TV evangelists kind of going back and forth to give you the feel of what this play is going to be about.
Excellent. All right. Well, we hope you have a great run. 5 performances beginning tonight at Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater, TU Theater presenting Molière's Tartuffe. Stephen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's been awesome.
University of Tulsa Theater Director Stephen Marzolf speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. TU Theater presents Molière's Tartuffe tonight through Sunday evening at Kendall Hall's Chapman Theater. Performance times are Thursday through Sunday at 8, with a Sunday matinee at 2 as well. For ticket information, call the TU box office at 918-631-2567 or visit myticketoffice.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
I've been following the local news reports about the Oklahoma Highway Patrol and efforts to increase both the number of troopers and their salaries. Since I am both socially conscious and a deep thinker, my immediate reaction was, how did the Highway Patrol come up with those cool hats? I love those hats. Now, this is where the Internet is invaluable for those of us with wandering curiosity. A quick search showed me a vast variety of military and law enforcement headgear, fatigue caps, Navy sailor hats, berets, and officer's peak cap with a stiff bill. Triangular caps like an ice cream soda worker, or think of the more flamboyant ones, saucy French gendarme kepi hats like Jack Lemmon wore in Irma La Douce, the broad-brimmed cavalry hat, maybe pimped up like General George Custer, the cute little French navy cap with a red pom-pom on top. And there are helmets and pith hats and slouchy jungle hats like a fisherman's headgear. But to my mind, none outshines the Oklahoma Highway Patrol's campaign hat. And that's the name of it, a campaign hat, with its stiff brim and four smart creases on the crown. Now, there's a hat that says authority. But the patrol uniform didn't start out like that. The Highway Patrol was established in 1937 by Governor E.W. Marland in response to a problem. And the problem was that the state highway system had grown, and so had the number of motor vehicles, and life on the road was wild and woolly. Well, Oklahoma citizens, being the way we are, liked it that way, and we resisted the idea of traffic regulations. But the story goes the patrolmen won us over with their courtesy and respect, plus the laws. A trooper then drove a 1937 Ford sedan equipped with a 2-gallon gasoline can, a red spotlight, a siren, and a ticket book. He had no radio, of course, in those days, and the only phones were those at farmhouses far, far apart. Their uniform included jodhpurs, riding breeches tucked into knee-high shiny black boots, and the jacket was belted with a Sam Brown belt and holster holding a .38 revolver. This smart uniform was topped with a hat that looked like a bus driver's or a guy pumping gas. As the uniform evolved into a more modern and, dare I say, more friendly look, the riding breeches and tall boots disappeared. But authority was maintained and maybe even increased when the squashed cap was replaced by the campaign hat. This hat originated among the armies posted in the West in the 1800s. Now, those troopers preferred a hat with a broad brim to keep the sun off their face. It became part of the official uniform of British and Canadian troops serving in Africa and during the Spanish-American War. And then by 1911, the crown was pinched into a four-crease Montana peak to direct the rain. By the 1930s, the flat brim was permanently stiff, and so it has remained. Now, this is the hat preferred by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, military drill sergeants, U.S. park rangers, hence the Smokey the Bear name hat, Boy Scout leaders, and highway patrols of many American states, including Oklahoma. And so, back to my original question, do I approve of more personnel and higher salaries for the Oklahoma Highway Patrol? Heck yes, I do. Smart dressers like that deserve it. Plus, they keep me safe on the open road.
Connie Cronley is a writer, essayist, and the executive director of Iron Gate, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.